Stand by, Jerry Saul Show. 5, roll tape. 4, cue Jerry. 3, bring audio up. 2, stand by. 1, play intro.
Stay tuned for the Terry Saul Show, Saltissimo, on Salem's original radio station, 104.3 and 1220 AM, KSLM.
Good morning and welcome to the Terry Saul Show on Salem's original radio station, KSLM, AM, and FM. I am your host and I'm so glad that you joined us this morning. Today our special guest is Dr. Melinda Massart. I'm not even going to try and figure out what you're the doctor of because you're the doctor of so much here. You're out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. First of all, good morning and welcome.
Thank you so much. Good morning.
Now tell me, you're a doctor of what? You're not a veterinarian. We know that.
I'm not a veterinarian. I actually wanted to be a veterinarian and my dad said, if you're going to do that much school, be a human doctor, please.
Did you really want to be a veterinarian?
I really did. I actually did summer veterinarian courses at Oregon State University when I was a child growing up.
Good for you. You're not a veterinarian right now, though. What are you?
I am a family medicine physician, and I also have a PhD in molecular biology and genetics. I work in a field called precision medicine.
Okay. And you work where?
At the University of Pittsburgh and University of Pittsburgh Medical Center in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Well, thank you for flying all the way out here just to be part of our show.
I really came out to visit my mom, but I'm very excited to
be on
your show.
Did you have to say that, though? Couldn't you have just lied?
I could have, but then she would have been really sad.
Oh, okay. Well, you're out here visiting your mom. We grabbed you here because there's a lot we want to talk about here. First of all, I showed you all the medications I'm on.
Yes.
And you shook your head when I pulled them all out and showed it to you. So what's the matter, Doc? What's wrong with me?
If you're comfortable with my saying on radio,
I am totally comfortable.
I can definitely guess your diagnoses based on your medication here. And your medication, quite honestly, looks a lot like most Americans over the age of 50. Many, many Americans have diabetes, mm-hmm. of which you have two medications for.
Is that common?
That's very common. You are not yet on insulin, it looks like.
Correct.
You are on oral medication to control your diabetes and hopefully working on diet and exercise to control your diabetes.
Does it look like that? Ask your mother.
Do you want me to tell your audience?
Ask your mother.
Honestly, I have to say you look better than the last time I saw you, so I think you have worked on it a little bit.
Well, I live with Nurse Cratchit.
That is very good. Very helpful, actually. Our environment really influences especially things like diabetes in our health, and whether we go on to develop diabetes and how severe our diabetes and how well controlled it is so affected by our diabetes.
Diabetes is a disease that you can control, can't you?
You absolutely can control diabetes. You know, diabetes is actually a great example of precision medicine. Diabetes, most likely there are many different genetic contributions to diabetes so that we're born with, but then it's really our environment and how we interact with our environment our entire life, which will truly manifest or not manifest the disease and how severe it is and how early in our life we start getting sick with diabetes. And that is definitely influenced by our nutrition and by our exercise, which then have an impact on our body shape. And then that body shape will go on to impact how quickly and how severe our diabetes is.
If I follow your program and every other doctor that keeps telling me exercise and lose weight, will I get rid of the diabetes or do I have it for life?
Depending on how severe your diabetes is, how far along the damage to your pancreas has been, you actually can reverse diabetes with diet and exercise completely. If someone's diabetes has already gotten to the point where they're dependent on insulin, it is very unlikely that they're going to reverse that, but they can control it extremely well with diet and exercise.
Because I'm not on insulin right now, I should get a jump on this thing then.
Absolutely.
Okay.
I think with proper weight loss and proper activity, you could completely get off diabetes medication.
Now, the one thing that I've noticed about the weight loss is we're down about 20 pounds now from the past month or so, 2 months now. And I know that I'm starting to have a little bit more energy, even though I still am fatigued. And I believe some of those other pills that might cause the fatigue.
You are on a medication, especially the gabapentin, which is for neuropathy, which is a secondary downstream consequence of diabetes, of having high blood sugars and damaging the nerve endings in your feet and in your legs and potentially your hands. Gabapentin is a commonly prescribed medication to treat that neuropathy, but it does make people very tired.
At the time, I was taking three a day. They had me up to three doses of that a day or three pills a day, and now I'm down to one a day because I complain so much about being fatigued. Three a day, is that a high dosage of what I'm taking there?
Gabapentin is typically dosed three times a day. That has more to do not with how high the dosage is, but how quickly the drug breaks down and is metabolized in your body. That in order to keep a steady state level in your bloodstream so that it's active and doing what we want it to do, some medications have to be dosed three times a day to do that. And gabapentin is one of those medicines. However, there's a large range of the dose of gabapentin. And you're on 300 milligrams.
Is that high?
Three times a day, which is not terribly high. Some people are on 800 milligrams three times a day.
Okay, so but it's coming down to once a day now. I'm taking it at night right before bedtime.
That's great. So that will make you less sleepy during the daytime by just having it at nighttime.
Want to bet?
I hope. But it's true that getting back to the diabetes, once you start losing the weight, you will cross a threshold point where your energy will get better and you'll actually almost start craving to exercise and be more active when you get to that point. Kind of gets into a feedback loop that's really positive. You lose the weight, you start getting more energy,
right,
you want
right.
to actually exercise. And exercise for a diabetic literally can be walking around the block, but you want
chasing
to have
a
that
granddaughter.
Movement. Chasing a granddaughter is great exercise. Walking a dog is great activity and exercise. Then the more you're exercising, the more it assists with the weight loss. So it turns into a really positive cycle.
The fact that I only have one kidney, taking all of this medication that I'm taking, are they fighting with each other, these pills?
So the medicine that you're taking are not fighting with each other. You have to remember that medication is metabolized differently depending on the specific medication. Some medication is metabolized by the liver. A lot of medication is metabolized by the liver, and some medication is metabolized by the kidney. Yours is sort of a mixture of which ones are through the liver and which ones are through the kidney. And right now you don't have any in this list that are fighting with each other. My guess is that your doctor and your pharmacist are watching that very closely. That's one of their jobs, is to make sure they don't give you medication that's going to fight with your body or that's going to fight with each other and impact you in a negative way.
What else am I taking here?
I see.
The Xarelto?
Cholesterol medication.
But my cholesterol's good.
Probably because you're taking a great cholesterol medication. that's actually a really interesting thing that we see a lot in medicine. My patients will come in and they'll say, I don't have high cholesterol. I don't have high blood pressure. Well, that's because you're actually taking the medication that's treating it. And so it's at goal. It's where we want it to be. But if someone stopped the medication, it would shoot right back up into those dangerous levels again. So you are taking a cholesterol medication. You have Xarelto, which is a blood thinner, yes.
He had me taking the Xarelto plus an aspirin, and I guess it was a low dose of aspirin. The problem with that is that when I'm shaving, if I cut myself, I'll bleed for a month.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the downside of blood thinners, right? We've all watched those late night commercials on TV. They're saying which drug and how horrible it is and all the terrible effects. And if you've had those to call and get into the class action lawsuits. And I used to always laugh when the blood thinner ones would come on and they would say, have you been on a blood thinner and bled, you know, and had a bleeding accident?
Right.
And I think it's really funny because, you know, that's, of course, what the purpose of a blood thinner is to thin the bleed, you know, to thin the blood out so that you don't clot. And there are many different health conditions for why people can be put on a blood thinner. If they've had a clot, like in their leg, which we call a DVT, or it's gone to their lung, which is called a pulmonary embolus. If you've had a stroke, if you've had a heart attack and have a stent, you might be on a blood thinner. And if you have atrial fibrillation, which is an irregular beating of the heart, which puts you at higher risk to have a stroke, you can be put on a blood thinner. So the whole purpose is to thin the blood, but it has to be in a very finely balanced range, not too thin and not too thick. Even at that not too thin range, you're still going to bleed if you cut yourself or you fall and you bang and hit your head. So we get always very concerned and have to weigh those risks and benefits when we put people on blood thinners.
I have the AFib. How do they determine that's what I have? How do you determine that? I know that we went into the hospital one day. We thought we were having some heart attack, and they said, no, you're not.
Yeah.
And then they did some more testing and said, well, you have AFib. And that's when they put me on this thing.
AFib is really funny. Atrial fibrillation is something that some people feel. Other people don't. They actually we just find it incidentally. They don't even have any symptoms. You definitely had symptoms, which is why you went in. It's diagnosed with an EKG. So when they put those electric leads on your chest and they watch on the monitor, we can see the pattern that is called atrial fibrillation.
Now, will I have that the rest of my life?
So some people have atrial fibrillation chronically every single day, and they have to be on medication to control their heart rate in the atrial fibrillation pattern. Other people go in and out of atrial fibrillation, and it's random and unpredictable. Sometimes they're on medication to help control the heart rate if they do go into it, but most of the time they're on a blood thinner so that if they do go in and out, they don't form that blood clot and have a stroke.
When they were doing my examination when we had that little incident, he said that there is a good chance that you might have a blood clot. And all of a sudden, once he said that, everybody got real serious all of a sudden. Blood clots are serious stuff, aren't they?
Blood clots are very serious stuff. And depending on where they form in the body, they then travel. And that's where it gets serious. So if a blood clot forms in the heart, it can travel to the brain and cause a stroke. If a blood clot forms in our lower part of our body, it travels to our lungs and causes that pulmonary embolus. And pulmonary emboli can be small and minimal and have minimal symptoms, and they can be lethal in one foul swoop. So it's a very serious thing to be aware of.
You said it can be lethal. How long would that take? If you have a blood clot, what's your time frame?
Well, when they are lethal, they are typically sudden death.
Really?
So someone typically doesn't even know they have a blood clot. It's instantaneous when they are lethal.
How do you prevent a blood clot?
So there are many ways to prevent a blood clot. There are several risk factors for having blood clots first. There's actually a genetic risk factor for having blood clots. There are a couple different genetic variants that place people at higher risk. Those run in families, and it's super important to know about that if it runs in your family, both before you have surgery, which can also be an independent risk factor for having a blood clot, especially if you already have a genetic predisposition. Being non-mobile can put you at risk for having a blood clot. So after having a surgery and laying around and not being ambulatory, not walking around, or on long flights, you may have heard on long trips that people are encouraged to get up and walk around every few hours or do foot and leg exercises so they don't form blood clots. So many, many different reasons why we can have a blood clot and important to be aware of. The number one risk sign that you might have a blood clot is if you have redness or swelling in one leg only. If that ever happens, that needs to be checked out emergently.
What do they do for a blood clot? Let's just assume we're having one in our leg. What do they do?
So the one in the leg is called the DVT, and they will put you on a blood thinner, like the blood thinner that you're on. The most common blood thinner is warfarin or Coumadin, which requires a lot of monitoring to be put on, but is the least expensive. We now also have injectable medicine, such as Lovenox, that sometimes people get to inject in themselves every single day. Sometimes people are put in the hospital on a heparin drip to break up a blood clot. And now we have the pills like the Xarelto that you're taking that are approved for different indications for treatment of blood clot as well.
And how long will that take? If we determine that I'm having a blood clot in my leg, how long will it take? On the the medication before, we're clear again.
It actually takes several weeks to months to completely
break
up.
But I don't have that long. You told me I don't have that long.
It won't, if it wasn't instantaneous, then they're normally very treatable.
Okay.
So they're not all lethal. That's an important part to remember.
Okay. All right. What else you got me on over there?
Oh, my goodness. We have you on heartburn medicine.
Okay. Well, that's a fairly new one, too, and I'm not sure why I'm on that one. I don't have heartburn.
That's very interesting. We should talk about that when we come back from the break.
All right. What is she now, watching my clock and everything else? All righty. We are going to take a break right now. It's a short break. When we come back, more with today's special guest, and we'll actually going to get off my medication and talk about some other stuff, too. You're listening to The Terry Saul Show on Salem's original radio station, 104.3 FM, 1220 AM. We are KSLM. Back in just a moment. Hang on, folks. This is going to get real interesting. Welcome back to the Terry Saul Weekend Show. Today's guest is Melinda Massart. Did I get it right?
Yes.
All right. She is a doctor from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. What's the weather like in Pittsburgh right now? Is it cold back there?
It is cold and snowy.
Cold and snowy. And that's why you're out here in sunny, warm Oregon.
That's right. That's why I come here in the winter, to have the best weather.
That's exactly right. Well, we were talking before on our last segment there about my medications. And first of all, we have to let people know, I'm asking you these questions, okay? You're not voluntarily sitting up here telling everybody what's wrong with me. I'm asking you. So we're not violating any laws or anything there, okay? And second of all, you're not giving any medical advice out right now. You're just answering my questions.
Correct.
Okay, so we're clear.
Perfect. Thank you for clarifying that.
Now, let's finish talking real quickly about my medications here, because you're having a field day with them.
I am having a field day with them. So we were just talking about the acid-reducing medication, and that you weren't really sure why you're taking it, although...
For the acid reflux?
For the acid reflux that you don't have, you said, or didn't know you have.
21 years ago I had it.
But not since then.
Right. So why do I still need to take those pills?
I mean, I think that brings up a really good point. I do have a suspicion of why your doctor put you back on this medication. You were talking to me about this recent chronic cough, and I think your doctor's trying to work through the list of what we call the differential, the possible different diagnoses that could be causing this chronic cough. And one of those could be silent acid reflux.
Okay.
I suspect that's what's going on. Again, that's just my professional opinion. But I think it brings up a good point, is that, you know, we also talked earlier about that you're on three blood pressure medications, and you said, but I don't have high blood pressure. It's so important as a patient to be your own advocate and to know your diagnoses and to know your medications and to know what each medication is for, and to make sure you're not accidentally put on duplication of medication. You said earlier about medications that might cross-react with each other. And as I said, that's one job of your doctor and pharmacist, is to protect you from that. But these days, people have a lot of doctors, and they even go to multiple pharmacies, which is different than the old days. All the records are electronic, but they're only as good as the information that was put into them. So this actually gets to a little bit of precision medicine, which is what I am very interested in, which is really everyone needs to have that ownership and advocate for themselves and know exactly what's in their electronic health records, and that all the people who are involved in their healthcare have access to the right information so accidents don't happen that way.
I'm noticing nowadays, in the past couple of years, when I go into my doctor's office and he pulls up, he's pulling up records from previous doctors from different hospitals. I mean, it seems like everybody's networked together.
Yeah, there are actually massive, large initiatives to make this happen for that very reason, for what I just talked about, because of safety. And the best way to ensure safety is open communication between the different health systems. When health records were built, they were really built with billing and coding in mind. They were not built with medical care necessarily in mind. The real point is to take care of the patient, to take care of the individual person. And so things are now evolving. I think physicians and other providers are largely responsible for driving that and saying we must have access to all this information.
Could you tell back in Pittsburgh what I'm on?
No.
Do you have access to my files back there?
No, I don't. But for example, in Pittsburgh, I can access the electronic health record at UPMC where I work, but there's also other large medical institutions in the area, and we now have a data sharing agreement that I can access their data, which is tremendously helpful. Before, I would have had to wait to have a fax sent to me if they knew to send a fax to me. And then how does that fax get integrated into the health record? If it gets scanned in, does it just get lost in the abyss? It is really improving that we are getting this shared access. I do think that there will be a point in the next 5 years where I will be able to access health information from anywhere in the United States, but we're not quite there yet. It's much more regional right now.
You are involved with a program called Precision Medicine. What is that?
I've talked about that a little bit already today, but let me tell you more about precision medicine. Precision medicine is really the practice of healthcare where you take into consideration a person's individual genetics and then all of their environmental exposures, their family history, their nutrition, their exercise or lack of exercise, their traumas. And you add all of that up to really look at someone's individual health. So on that way, we really can start treating people as a unique individual. We can tailor their medications to them. So we talked a lot about medication today, which actually is a perfect example. There's a part of precision medicine that's called pharmacogenomics.
What is that?
And pharmacogenomics is looking at the genetics of metabolism. Remember how I said earlier that a lot of medications metabolized in the liver and in the kidney? We know a lot about all of the enzymes and the receptors that are involved in different drug metabolism. And those are mostly generated by your genetic code. And so we each have unique genetic variants that lead to how we metabolize medication. So that's why one medication can work for one person and not the next person. Or somebody can have a bad adverse reaction to a medication, but the next three people in line tolerate the medication just fine. That's all because of pharmacogenomics. So a specific example would be to look at, well, we talked about blood thinners earlier. We talked about warfarin or Coumadin, which is one of the most common blood thinners. And there's actually two or three different very common genetic variants involved in the entire metabolism of that medication. So based on someone's genetics, they may need a higher dose of that medication or they may need a lower dose of that medication. Or based on the addition of all of those variants, we can better know what type of dosing. And as we talked about with blood thinners, we want to be not too thick of blood and we want not too thin of blood. If it's too thick, someone will have a clot again, which would be a bad event. If it's too thin, someone could bleed. So by using the genetics, we are showing now in the literature that we're better able to predict a dosing for each individual person for that medication.
Unbelievable. How did you get involved with this?
So I, as I mentioned earlier, I actually went to graduate school first and did my PhD in molecular biology and genetics. And I was very fascinated with that and went on to medical school with the intent to become a medical geneticist. However, I completely fell in love with primary care. And at the time, we were finishing the Human Genome Project, partially at where I was going to school. And I realized that when we completed that project, genetics was going to really impact all aspects of medicine, especially primary care, and looking at both the treatment of conditions and preventing conditions.
We need to take a short break. When we come back, more with today's guest, Melinda Massart, MD, from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Back in just a moment.
You're listening to The Terry Saul Show on Salem's original radio station, 104.3 FM and 1220 AM, KSLM.
We're back in 5, 4, cue Terry, 2, 1, you're on.
Our guest today is Melinda Massart, MD from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. How long have you been a doctor?
So I finished my PhD in 2001 at the University of Utah in Salt Lake City. And then I graduated from Oregon Health Sciences Medical School in 2006. I completed my residency in Portland at the Providence Milwaukee Family Medicine Residency, which was a wonderful place to train. And now I'm in my 10th year of practice.
And you're back east on the East Coast.
Yeah.
How'd you end up back there?
Well, I actually went first to Idaho and practiced for 5 years in Caldwell, Idaho, which is just outside of Boise. It was a wonderful place to live and raise my children when they were younger. We became huge rodeo fans in Idaho. However, we knew that at some point we needed to move on. We are Jewish, and we really wanted to be in a Jewish community. And we were very fortunate when we researched across the country to find a fantastic Jewish community in Squirrel Hill in Pittsburgh. Many of you probably are familiar with Squirrel Hill now, unfortunately, due to the shooting that we recently had at one of our synagogues. But it is a truly amazing, close-knit Jewish community. And since it was located where there was such fantastic medicine and research science going on at the University of Pittsburgh, it was a great place for us to go.
Were you close to that shooting?
We're just a few blocks from the synagogue.
Mm.
Yeah, and actually my mom was in Pittsburgh during the shooting because my husband and I went to China to a large precision medicine conference and genomics conference when it happened. And it was absolutely surreal to be watching CNN in China and seeing my neighborhood.
Just wanted to get on a plane and come home right away, didn't you?
I wanted to come home and just hold my children and be with my community. And it was just a terribly heartbreaking experience.
Sure.
And I happened to be friends of the first officer who arrived on scene, who was injured in the line of duty that day. And last weekend, our community held a beautiful event for the Jewish community to honor all of the officers who were involved that day, who we feel very certain protected us from further harm that could have occurred.
First responders, they're the real heroes.
First responders are tremendous heroes. We should never, ever forget that.
That's exactly right. We're talking about precision medicine. Tell me a little bit more about precision medicine.
Before the break, we were talking about pharmacogenomics as an example of precision medicine. So going along that story, one aspect of precision medicine that I like to talk about is depression. So depression runs in many families.
Okay, can I stop you right there? Let's talk a little about this depression. How do you know whether you're depressed or just having a bad day?
Well, depression tends to last more than one day. I think we're all allowed to have bad days. We all have ups and we all have downs. Depression gets to the point where we no longer enjoy doing the things that we used to enjoy doing, no matter what those were. Hanging out with friends or family or certain crafts or activities or work and friends. When depression starts affecting our joy of the things that we used to be happy doing and starts impacting our ability to function, when you can no longer get out of bed in the morning, can't get to work on time, you're having relationship issues with those you love, then depression becomes a real diagnosis and starts severely impacting you. Most people at that point will start to seek help because it becomes so significant at that point. And there's actually a long history of depression in my family. And I don't even know how many generations ago it started, but most definitely my paternal grandmother was depressed and maybe had additional diagnoses. And
back then, they didn't know how to treat it?
They had limited treatment. There was a lot of psychotherapy. There wasn't a lot of medication yet. And unfortunately, my grandmother took her own life from her depression. And my father inherited her depression and was impacted significantly by that in his lifetime. I myself have had bouts of depression. And now I see my children and other family members being affected. So when depression starts affecting people to the level where, as I said before, it's really impacting their life, often physicians will recommend therapy and medication.
What type of medication?
Yeah, so the research has shown that the two of them work best together. And that's the medication is the complicated part that I want to talk about, because there are many different classes of antidepressant medication. When you're the physician or the provider and you want to choose a medication, it's kind of like throwing a dart at a dartboard, right? You want to hit that bullseye, but you don't really know which one to pick. And we know from experience that not all medications work in all people the same way. Often you'll ask someone, were you ever on a medication before that worked? And if they say yes, that's great. And you would start there. Or you might say, has anyone in your family been on a medication before that worked for them? Because assuming they probably have similar genetics in the family, and that might be helpful. Or you may not have anyone or any history to go from to start with. And so you might choose your favorite class or your one that you know is the least expensive or has the least amount of side effects. And you start there. And then you throw that dart at the dartboard and go. And then you have someone come back in 4 weeks and you see how they're doing. And sometimes they'll come in and they say, oh my goodness, doctor, I was so nauseous and so dizzy that after 3 days I stopped taking the medication. And then we just lost 3.5 weeks of potential therapeutic effort and we've made no changes. Or they might come in and they say, well, I didn't have any bad side effects, but I don't really feel any better. And then we have to decide, do we go up on the dose or do we give up and go to a different class of medication? And then, of course, they come back another month and it's the same thing. And it often will take 3 to 6 months to find the right medication and the right dose to get someone therapeutic. But what happens to someone with depression in 3 to 6 months? A lot. They're a young person. They could fall out of school for that time, which is detrimental. If you're an adult, you could lose a job in 3 to 6 months of severe depression. You could lose a marriage in 3 to 6 months of severe depression. Or like in the case of my grandmother, you could lose your life in 3 to 6 months of depression.
So depression is very real then. It's not, oh, just get over it. It's very real.
That's the worst thing you can ever say to someone who's depressed or has anxiety. Oh, just get over it. It is very, very, very real. And
what do you say? If you have somebody who suffers from depression, what do you tell them when they're going through one of their low periods?
Yeah, it depends on your relationship with that person. But I think the most important thing is to be supportive and let them know that you care about how they're feeling. You recognize that what they're feeling is real and you offer to be supportive in whatever way you can. And if they're not getting medical treatment, to encourage them strongly to seek medical treatment. And so in terms of precision medicine and pharmacogenomics, what I'm really hoping is that very soon, the level of evidence will get to the point where as a doctor or provider, I can look at an individual patient's genetics, look at their environment, look at their family history, and like I said, all those other exposures, and pick the right medicine the very first time and the right dose the very first time so we don't have to keep playing that game. And so when I throw that dart at the dartboard, that I hit that bullseye from the get-go. That's what precision medicine is all about, the right medication for the right person at the right time at the right dose.
Other than medication, what are some other examples of precision medicine?
There are so many different examples of precision medicine, and really, I think every single individual has a precision medicine story if you talk to them long enough. And if they're young and healthy and lucky to not have a precision medicine story of their own, they have someone near and dear to them who does.
What's the typical story?
Yeah. So, for example, my father, who passed away this last year, was someone who was a vegetarian. He exercised twice a day for almost his entire life, was very physically fit. And if you were going to line him up with 100 other men his age, he would not have been the person that you would have said was going to die from a sudden heart attack.
How old was he?
And he was 75. So I think, you know, in that case, that precision medicine story is there was so much more beneath the surface that was going on that he and his doctors weren't aware of. He definitely had a genetic family history of heart disease. He actually did have one heart attack early in his 50s, which was treated, and he did phenomenally well after that. But there was probably much more to it, whether it was what amount of alcohol he was drinking or where he was living in his local environment or additional genetic contributions that he wasn't aware of with high cholesterol or high blood pressure. Other things added up and contributed to really significant heart disease for him. For me, that precision medicine story as his daughter is, you know, I most likely inherited those very same genetics. So what can I do about the modifiable risk factors? What are the modifiable risk factors that I can change in my lifetime to make sure that I don't end up with that same story? Another example of precision medicine, and again, because I think precision medicine is very personal, it's about the human being, I'm sharing my stories today. Mm-hmm. But last year I was diagnosed with melanoma, and the melanoma was on the bottom of my foot, so not a highly sun-exposed place. In addition to that, I have no family history of melanoma, and ironically, I'm allergic allergic to the sun, which I inherited from my grandmother. So I really don't go out in the sun. It was in a non-sun exposed space of my body. And we have no family history of this type of skin cancer. And I need to know why. I need to know what were the genetic reasons and the environmental reasons that led to my getting this cancer in my mid-40s so that I can make sure my children don't have that same story. I want to make sure that they know how to prevent that from occurring in the future.
Were you able to get the answers you were looking for?
Not yet. That all has to come through research. So precision medicine is a new field, and we need to do a lot more research to better understand what are all of those components that are adding up to these individual health issues.
Is precision research just on the East Coast, or is that nationwide, worldwide?
So we actually, at the University of Pittsburgh, are really proud to be a part of a national precision medicine research program, which is called the All of Us Research Program, which is administered through the National Institutes of Health, the NIH. And there are several sites all around the country, large academic centers, community affiliations that are all supporting this national project to actually recruit a million individuals that reflect the diversity of our whole entire country to contribute and participate in precision medicine research so that we can actually start answering these questions.
Our guest today is Melinda Mastert, MD. She is the Assistant Professor, Medical Director at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. And boy, that's a mouthful, isn't it?
Yes, but it's not the whole medical center, I have to say. Well, it's my little clinic.
Yeah, but you have your own building named after you, don't you? Or a building or office space or something named after you?
Not even close.
Have you seen my name anywhere in this radio station? They don't name anything after me around here. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to talk about this other program called the All of Us Research Program. And what's that all about real quickly? We only have about a minute or so left here on the segment.
Yeah, so as I mentioned before, the All of Us National Research Program was started by President Obama in 2015 because he himself recognized that precision medicine was the future of the practice of medicine. But as we've talked about already today, we need to do a lot more research to understand that so that we can advance it and bring it back to the patients.
You're listening to The Terry Soul Show on Salem's original radio station, 104.3 FM and 1220 AM, KSLM.
Hey, this is Terry Saul, Saltissimo. I am so glad to be back on the air, and especially here at Salem's original radio station, KSLM AM and FM. Now, the incredible management team here at KSLM has given me the green light to not only air my show on Saturday mornings at 10 a.m., but now, in case you missed it, you can tune in to Sunday mornings at 11 a.m. for an encore broadcast. Now, if you miss both of them, I invite you to go to my website, www.terrysaul.com, and check out my podcast to listen to any or all of my past shows. Now, if you do that, well, I think you've got too much time on your hands. I have a lot of fun and exciting guests in the upcoming weeks, and we may just take this show with us on the road. So join us weekends for The Terry Saul Show, only on Salem's original radio station, 104.3 FM and 1220 AM, KSLM. We are back with our final few minutes of The Terry Saul Show on Salem's original radio station, 104.3 FM, KSLM. Our guest today is Dr. Melinda Mastert from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Do you ever listen to our radio show back there in Pittsburgh?
All the time.
Oh, you're good. You're real good. Today we're talking about, we're going to talk about just a little bit about everything here. We've been talking about precision medicine, but I also want to talk to you a little bit about a program called the All of Us Research Program. What is that all about?
Yeah. So as I mentioned earlier, the All of Us Research Program is a National Institute of Health sponsored program that was launched in 2015 as a concept and launched this last spring. We're coming up on our 1 year anniversary for enrolling research participants around the country. This program was developed to advance biomedical research with respect to precision medicine. As I mentioned before, all of the different aspects, our genetics, our environmental contributions and exposures, and how these contribute to both health, the prevention of disease, and the treatment of disease on that unique individual level. So to do that, we needed to collect much more data to actually catalyze research around the country around this concept. Historically, if you do research, you have to go out and recruit your own research population to participate in your research. And when you do that, that costs money, it takes time, it limits how many people you can access in your region, and the diversity that's reflected in that research is also limited by who the population is in your region. By actually creating this large research cohort across the country, we are doing all that groundwork for the future researchers. We are recruiting all the participants. We would like to get to 1 million or more research participants in this database. We are collecting some very basic data sets, including genetics and blood work and urine, body measurements, and research participants also consent to share their electronic health record information. All of that information is collected in a de-identified manner, so the researchers will never be able to track it back down to the individual level. And we're pooling all that information that we're collecting over the next 5 years together so that research scientists, instead of having to go out and spend the time and the money and have those limitations that I mentioned, will be able instead to apply to this massive, huge research database and access that information to do their research on. This will speed up research and save money and hopefully get things brought back to the clinic level, back to the patient level much, much faster.
Why would I want to submit myself to join this? Why would I want to do this?
Yeah, so I think there's many different reasons. One of the reasons is, as I mentioned before, we all have our own precision medicine story. And as you volunteered all your medications at the beginning of the show, we now know some of those things. So you might, for you, it might mean, you know, how do I make sure my granddaughter doesn't get diabetes and doesn't have the same atrial fibrillation and have to be on a lunch bag full of medication when she's your age, right? That might be your motivation. You want the health of the future to be better than our health was. You want to make sure that we do a better job taking care of future generations. That might be one person's motivation. Another person's motivation might say, this is a huge national project and I am proud to be a part of this country and I want to contribute to this huge research initiative. I always joke at our institution, I don't have $1 million to leave to the university, but I can spit in a tube and donate my DNA. That can be my living legacy to research, and it will probably outlive me, and research will continue on those samples for a long time to come. So you're actually contributing to something that's so powerful. Again, we can change the world one at a time, but we can change the world faster together, a million at a time. And so by contributing and allowing research to do this, we are actually giving a huge legacy to the future.
Can anybody join?
Currently, anyone over the age of 18 who makes their own decisions can join the program. We are working very diligently to be able to get individuals under 18, so the pediatric population, to be able to join. As you probably know, when you do research, we have to take into very strong consideration many different ethical components to ensure that we are achieving the highest level of ethical research as possible. So different subpopulations, such as children, take in additional components. Adults who have impaired memory or for whatever reason cannot make their own decisions also has additional considerations. So we are working on all of those now so that hopefully in the future, all of us will truly be all of us.
What type of health do you need to be in to join?
So we actually want everyone from all different health ranges to join this program. The more broad we have representation, the more useful that data is going to be. We want to understand wellness. I want to know why the 102-year-old lived to 102 in a very healthy way as much as I want to know why the 62-year-old, you know, is in a very unhealthy state. So it's not disease specific.
Now you're hitting a little close to home on that.
Sorry,
last one.
I didn't aim there. But, you know, we want to know what leads to leading a successful, healthy life just as much as we want to know what are the factors that lead to disease so that we can use all of that to promote health. So, of course, preventative health is always the primary, you know, goal. We want to prevent disease. We want to keep people healthy. But if someone does develop disease, we want to know how to treat them specifically in the way that is best for that unique individual.
How many people are currently enrolled?
So we actually just passed the 100,000 mark. York. We're very, very excited nationally.
How long has the program been going on?
Since May of this last year.
Oh, really?
So we're very, very excited to pass the 100,000 mark. We have a long way to go to a million. But I really think right now we need to get our name out there. Everyone needs to learn about the program and get excited and know how to enroll from their region.
And how do you enroll?
There are several ways to enroll, but the best way, go to our website, which is a national website, which is www.joinallofus.org. But if someone just types into a search network, the All of Us Research Program, it will pull it up either locally or nationally. Many sites around the country are set up for enrollment, whether someone's affiliated with a large academic center or whether they are at a small health center or don't even have a current provider that they're established with. There are ways for each of those candidates to join our program.
With our final minute and a half or so, Melinda, can you give us a website and contact information, everything else that we'd like to see? Are you guys on Facebook as well?
Yes. So I just gave the website. I'll give it one more time, which is www.joinallofus.org. And on Facebook, if you just search for All of Us Research Program, it will pull right up.
Okay. Melinda Massart from the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center has been our guest today. When are you heading back home to Pittsburgh?
I'm going to try to battle the snow tomorrow and get back home.
You know, it's 14 degrees there right now.
I know, but I need to go hug my children.
All righty. I've been looking forward to having you here for a long time. Thank you for giving me the information on my medical issues. And would you come back and join us again sometime?
Absolutely. Would love to. Thank you
all
so
right.
much.
We are just about out of time. A big thank you to our special guests. And remember, you can hear us each and every Saturday at 10 a.m. and an encore presentation Sundays at 11 a.m. right here on Salem's original radio station, 104.3 FM, 1220 a.m. We are KSLM. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Folks, and we're off. Thanks, everybody.
Bye, everybody.